Welcome to the Spring 2017 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. This annual lecture series is funded by NCLA's Academic Affairs, the Environmental Studies Department, and donors to the NCLA Foundation. Each semester, we invite a series of experts to come to campus to present on various aspects of sustainability and the environment. This semester, our series topic is the science and management of invasive species. Over the course of the semester, we will welcome to NCLA various experts from state and federal agencies, academia, nonprofits, and private industry. Each week, our guest speaker will delve into their area of expertise related to the research and management of invasive species in our state, region, as well as globally. Information and links to audio and video recordings of tonight's lecture will be posted at ncla.edu/greenliving. Tonight's speaker is Cynthia Botner. Cynthia works as a biologist for the Silvio O. Conti National Fish and Wildlife Refuge within the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There, she coordinates the refuge's invasive plant control initiative in the Connecticut River watershed, involving the participation and networking of multiple partners. She runs the program to stop the spread of water chestnut in the watershed and was one of the founding members of the Invasive Plant Atlas of New England and the Massachusetts Invasive Plant Working Group. She plans and implements small-scale priority control projects on refuge lands with the help of youth crews, college interns, and local volunteers. Cynthia received her Master's of Arts in Landscape Design from the Conway School of Landscape Design and a Bachelor of Arts from the University of Michigan in Environmental Studies. Please help me welcome Cynthia to NCLA.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thanks for coming out tonight. So, I work for the Silvio Conti National Fish and Wildlife Refuge, which is kind of a different kind of refuge than you might be used to. So, you've got this picture in your mind of this beautiful area, something that you might be able to look down at from an airplane or a satellite view, and it's one particular land holding, right? That's not what our refuge is. Okay. It's very different. I'm going to be I'll get into that, but I'm going to be talking about the importance of partnerships, prioritizing, and prevention when it comes to invasive species management. My refuge is the entire Connecticut River watershed. So it takes a large swath through New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. We're not inside of it here, but where I live, my town is inside of it, my office is inside of it, the University of Massachusetts and all the five college area. So it's not something that we own, of course, 7.2 million acres. But the idea of this refuge was to, as you can read there, to conserve, protect, and enhance the abundance and diversity of native species in the whole watershed. So the idea was that if we protected and did conservation work in the most important parts of the Connecticut River watershed and tried to engage the landowners and businesses in conservation measures, that we would have a healthier watershed. So in order to do that, of course, we need to work in partnerships, and a lot of the whole thing is education. Our refuge goes all the way. This is the northern area, so these beautiful spruce fir forests and moose habitat all the way down to Long Island Sound. It's kind of interesting, this particular photo that you see in this big cloudy area. That's after Hurricane Irene and all the silt that had been washed down through the watershed and out into Long Island Sound. But our refuge started with a 3.8-acre island. When I joined the refuge in 1999, and the refuge only started in 1997, when I joined in 1999, that was our refuge. That was all we owned as far as our ownership. It's now grown to 36,000 acres, so all the little blue spots that you see in there, that is what we own. So we're now up to, this map was done in 2015, we're now up to 37,000 acres. Picking up parcels that are important for wildlife, especially endangered species, with real good prime habitat. And we now have, we're going through a planning process where we're hoping to get the authority to even pick up more land from willing landowners. But because of this kind of unwieldy size of a watershed refuge, we do have to work on these three things when it comes to invasive species. We really have to choose our battles wisely. So what I'm going to be talking about tonight is what we do both on refuge properties and in the greater watershed. So some of the things, some of the main points we do for prioritizing are early detection and rapid response. So this is both on and off refuge properties. We have, if we see a new species coming into our lands that's invasive, we know that that's the easiest time to try to control it before it has a chance to really establish. Unfortunately, with 37,000 acres, our staff is based in Massachusetts. We have one staff up in northern Vermont and one staff down in the center of Massachusetts, Sunderland. So most of us have never seen the land that we actually own. So we're in this process of still purchasing, figuring out where these properties are, and trying to get a handle on it. So we're very new, and thus we're just kind of getting into the whole invasive species realm. The other thing we focus on are threats to the rare endangered species and plants that are the most imminent or concerning threat to our management goals. And we have to know what those goals are at each property. So we're just kind of working our way along here. This is one of the more common species, commonly known invasive species. Anybody know what it is? Can you tell just from that photo? Yeah, purple loosestrife, thanks. So this was just an example I had. This was taken before I even worked for the refuge, but this was a coworker of mine when I worked for UMass. She saw this big field, and there was this one single purple loosestrife plant growing in it and blooming, and she said, I know that shouldn't be there. I'm going to dig it out. So next time we were out there, she brought her shovel, got it out, and disposed of it properly. And when we went back years later, it didn't look like this. Okay, this is not that same field, but it could have been if she had left that there. A purple loosestrife plant can produce over 2 million seeds, and it has a really high germination rate. This field that she pulled it out of wasn't necessarily prime habitat, because purple loosestrife really does well in wetlands, but even still, there would have been more, I believe, if she hadn't done that. So just the idea of early detection, rapid response, can work even on a common species that's common elsewhere and causing problems elsewhere, but might be new to your town or new to a particular wildlife sanctuary. So we look at this whole idea of early detection and rapid response on many different scales. So where we do have a sense of what we've got on the properties that we're familiar with, we have to make some decisions, because depending on where we're at in the watershed, there can be a lot of invasive plants. So we have to think about what our management goals are, what might be threatening those goals, and whether controlling a particular species is worth the effort and is actually something we can afford to do. So we really have to think about, at what level do we leave it? It's not really causing that much problem. Do we actually, is it so bad that we might and so little that we could actually eradicate it. Eradication is really hard to do because seeds fall, leave, and seeds can remain viable for a really long time. So most likely we'd be thinking more about containing a population or suppressing it. So what we do is we go out and inventory the land and make maps. I don't necessarily have those to be able to show you. I think I might have one in here. And then we figure out what we might want to do. And in the southern properties, those are where there's more invasive plants. It's warmer, they're just really thriving. So in Connecticut and Massachusetts, it's pretty well inundated. And there we've honed in on the idea of just trying to rein in those really rapid dispersers, those that would be causing problems, and then those that are threatening our management goals. So a couple examples of species that are rapid dispersers are garlic mustard and Japanese stilt grass. So those are two that we do focus on. Japanese stilt grass is one that not many people are aware of. How many people here have even heard of this one? Good. So the name is out there. How many people have actually seen it in person? All right, where are you from? Florida? Oh, no wonder. Yeah, it's a worse problem further south, definitely. So this was taken in New Jersey, actually, and the people in the mid-Atlantic states had warned us New Englanders, if there's any way you can keep this species from taking over like it did down where we live, you should do it. So we did spend a lot of time trying to rein this one in. And when we did our inventory at our Salmon River Division in Connecticut, the bright green spots here, you can see them following the riverways, was where Japanese stilt grass was. So we had to figure out, okay, where are we going to try to control it? But that's the one example I have of the kind of maps, one of the kinds of maps that we do. So there's Japanese stilt grass at our Salmon River Division. We got our Youth Conservation Corps out there weed whacking. This is an annual that can be controlled just by preventing seed set. At least it can be managed for that year. There's still seeds in the soil. Then at our Fort River Division, which is the most local division, this is a property that's about, I think it's around 150, 200 acres in Hadley, Massachusetts. It has fields. It was a horse farm, so it's got these fields that are really good grassland habitat for grassland birds. And that's what we've decided we should manage it for, because in the greater context, there are a lot of other farms and the grassland birds are doing pretty well there. So that's one management goal we have. And the other is to protect the floodplain forest. The river, the Fort River that goes through, harbors rare and endangered mussels, and they really thrive in cold water. So we're trying to keep that shade going on our lands. And to do that, we have to protect the trees. What can you expect is one of the worst threats to the health of trees when it comes to invasive plants? You got it. Yep, that's it. Oriental bittersweet. It is, I think, yeah. So you can see just how it just grows up, covers the overstory of the forest, grabbing all the sunlight. The trees aren't able to photosynthesize. They get weaker. The ice storms that might be coming through further weaken the tree. They come crashing down. So our partner of the Nature Conservancy has been doing a lot of floodplain forest research and showing that the bittersweet has just been really, really harmful to that habitat. So between the mussels and the migratory birds coming through and using that habitat, this is one focal species. We've also put in a bird and nature trail there. So that's another thing we're doing, is controlling the invasives along the trail and engaging a friends group to help us with that, so that we can at least make the trail area, try to turn it back into more of a native habitat. Mm-mm. This particular property is just inundated with multiflora rose. And if you've ever been through multiflora rose, okay, I see a nodding of the head and an ouch. Yes, thorns are really crazy on these. In fact, the people who came and helped us with an inventory, they were from Utah, used to these wide open spaces and, you know, the really thin pants that are good for the field in the summertime. And they went through an hour's worth of multiflora rose and they went back to their field station running, I think, because they just couldn't handle it. So because this is so bad, we've decided we would just disrupt the environment way too much to try to control it at this point in time. So we focused on the bittersweet, but logistically speaking, in order to get to the bittersweet, we had to cut multiflora rose down just to make pathways through it. The Nature Conservancy also informed us that there's a disease coming through that impacts multiflora rose. We discovered it on this refuge early this spring, so we're hoping that the rose disease will take care of itself. It's called rose rosette disease. We'll see what happens. But this is one of the properties where we're working on garlic mustard. This is a species that has a chemical that it emits from the root, so it's allelopathic. And what it does is it disrupts the mycorrhizal fungi that are helping the native plants take up nutrients. So by disrupting the native plant's ability to take up nutrients, it is just able to thrive. So this is a biennial plant, and many, many seeds come off this plant that lasts for 7 to 10 years. So it's a real long-term process to get this under control. And mainly we've been doing it in our Fort River Division just with volunteers by hand pulling. Considering the federal budget the way it's been of late, we really have had to focus mostly on hand control, just hand tools, hand pulling. So you can imagine that we can't get all that far just with that kind of technique. We have another property in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and it used to be a ski slope. And when I talked about partnerships, we worked in partnership to preserve the mountain. We got the ski slopes, other partners got the woods and the lodge and buildings that were associated with the ski slopes went to another partner. So we've all been trying to work away on conservation at this property. And there are some state-listed rare plants, including down here in the lower right, a sedge called Carex glaucodia, and an orchid that's next to that, which looks really gorgeous in this picture, but the flowers are only this big. So we're trying to help the state protect these rare species, and it's just perfect habitat for them. We had, this one is way out of place here. When I was mentioning that we do a lot of handwork, it's actually students from the University of Massachusetts that have been helping us a lot. So they helped us do, actually Westfield State University helped us do inventory. That's what the upper right people are doing. And then UMass students were helping pull out, in this case, glossy buckthorn. And we had garlic mustard pullers earlier that year. But back to Mount Tom. We had a species there called pale swallowwort, and it was taking over all the open ski slope lands. So we were looking at that and the other species that were up on Mount Tom, and we used this technique used by the National Park Service to analyze every species that was up there and kind of characterize it as far as feasibility of control, as you see on the x-axis, and significance of impact. So just how much was it impacting the native species out there? And once we plotted all the different species on this kind of a graph and saw where they fell into the graph, we saw that the worst species was actually the most serious threat, was actually hard to control too, but we decided to go after it. Most logical people will go after the things that are a serious threat but easy to control and just knock those out of the water, okay? Then you might want to go with a lesser threat, and you have to decide, do I want to do a lesser threat that's easier to control or harder to control? So there's a decision-making process that can go into this to help you decide what you really want to go for and based on how feasible it is. So we went after the pale swallowwort. You can see that it was not very feasible to control and had a significant impact. But it was just taking over, and this is just one small area. I mean, those are the ski slopes, all those lines up on the mountain there. And the dark orange was really severe infestations of pale swallowwort. The gold color is pale swallowwort that was not quite so bad, but pretty bad. So, and that's, of course, where the rare plants were, too. So we wanted to try to bring this under control. It also is related to milkweed. And anybody think of any species that's related to milkweed? Any? Pardon? Monarch butterflies, exactly. Well, there's been studies that show that monarch butterflies will lay their eggs on this pale swallowwort that's closely related, but the caterpillars don't survive. So that was another reason why we just wanted to try to get rid of this. So we went after it. We hired a contractor to come in with this big tank full of herbicide, and then they sprayed the individual plants. So we weren't spraying the whole thing. They were just spraying individual pale swallowwort plants. We had the Natural Heritage and Endangered Species staff come up and help us. That's what Jennifer there is doing in the left. She was actually using a glove wipe technique on the pale swallowwort right in close proximity to the swallowwort. Then we had, when that was just way too time consuming, we switched over to backpack sprayers around the pale swallowwort. So we did this for several years. We spent a lot of money. We probably spent at least $50,000 to try to bring this species under control. And we ran out of money. So we had to just stop the whole contractor end of things. Natural Heritage still comes up, works around the rare plants. So the nice patches of these rare species are now not inundated anymore by pale swallowwort. So we're keeping the swallowwort at bay from the rare species. But that's about all for now. We do have hopes that a researcher in Rhode Island who's been working on biological control of an insect that feeds on swallowworts might get the permission soon to be able to release that. So we're hopeful that that might be our saving grace. But even just to use herbicide, these are all the things we have to supply information to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in order to use herbicide. So it's not something we take lightly. We try to use it very sparingly. So I've been talking more about the southern properties that we own. Now we'll go up to the northern properties, which are much more pristine. And the idea is, let's keep them pristine. There are just a few species that are really bad there, but still not bad. We've actually got them under control on our properties, and that's purple loosestrife, Japanese knotweed, and Phragmites, or common reed. So with the Japanese knotweed, we're actually able to inject just a little tiny bit of herbicide into the stem, which controls the knotweed and minimizes the impact on the surrounding plants. And the Phragmites control, you might see that kind of bluish haze. That's where dye in herbicide was used on the Phragmites, and that way they can tell where they've treated and where they haven't. And then we always have to wash off our equipment really well afterwards in order to not be spreading seeds from this place to the next place that particular piece of equipment goes to. So we spend a lot of time just in prevention efforts. And then we do these workshops up in the northern realm and down in the southern area as well to teach people what the new invaders are coming into the watershed, so that people can be on the lookout for them, and if they see them, they would report them. So I've been talking about just our refuge properties up till now. Now I'd like to just talk a little bit about what we're doing in the greater watershed that still is within our boundary, our legislated boundary. When the refuge first started, this particular infestation was found. If you can imagine, this is not dry land here. This is a cove, Log Pond Cove in Holyoke, Massachusetts. So it's a cove of the Connecticut River. And this is water chestnut on the cove. And those plants were so, usually a water chestnut plant just kind of floats flat on the water. And it grows in these rosettes, which I'll show you later. And it was so dense here that those rosettes were all squeezed together, so it was all standing upright like this. And it just looked beyond hope. This is the species here, and we thought that this was the only place where water chestnut was in our watershed. It was the only place that had ever been reported to us. So we decided to try to control it. It has these real spiny seeds. You might have seen these. It's actually in the Housatonic River, too. But it grows on these long stems with multiple rosettes all on one plant. And what we did was we got together a bunch of partners, town, state, federal, and started to control it by mechanical harvester. And it was very cumbersome and very expensive to do that. The harvester has to scoop it up, cut it, scoop it up, take it to a place near shore, but couldn't get it up onto shore. So then an excavator would have to take it up off the shore area and put it into dump trucks, which would take it away. And we just get mounds and mounds of these plants that decompose really fast. But it's very, it was very... just a lot of handling. And because of that, because of the expense, and year after year we are trying to work on this particular population and not getting anywhere because there are just so many seeds built up in the water, that we had to turn to herbicide. So probably about 8 years now we've been using herbicide, and it still isn't under control. So this project has taught me that, again, that just trying to catch these species early before they have a chance to dump all their seeds in is so important. This particular species has a 12-year seed viability, which means that in any one of the next 12 years after it's produced, a seed will germinate. So you never know, is it going to be next year or is it going to be 10 years from now when that seed comes up? So it's just such a long-term project. We now are hand-pulling it in places that have been reported to us in different lakes, ponds, and coves in the watershed. So we have this volunteer force, which changes every year. People come, they might work a few days, come back again next year. Or they might, this is the once-in-a-lifetime thing. And then there's some people are so devoted to it, they're actually adopting a water body and coming back and really taking care of that particular water body. So it really varies from place to place, but this is water chestnut right here. And the point of this particular photo was you can't just pass even one of Rosette by or your population really doesn't change much in the future. So that's one rosette. So, and there's many rosettes on one plant, as I said. So if that one rosette we passed by and didn't notice, it could generate this much, not necessarily next year as this picture shows, but sometime within the next 12 years. And then those could generate four and a half times this amount. So you can see how that Log Pond Cove situation came to be. So we're out hand pulling from canoes. We have a youth crew too, high school youth that are supervised by college age and post-college people. We're now up to 37 sites that we're managing. This has been our most challenging site. It's really a bad photo I'm seeing, but it's called the Brickyard in Westfield, Massachusetts. And if you see all these dark spots, these are all pondlets where clay had been excavated out of the earth to create bricks. And all those little pondlets are interconnected, but you might just be able to get through with a canoe and that's it. And someone reported, an angler actually reported water chestnut in here a couple years ago. We went in and it was incredible. Just some of the pondlets were just totally infested. And it was unfortunately reported too late to do anything about it that year. So the next year, we contacted UMass to see if they wanted to come out and help us try to figure out what we had there. So they actually engaged a new partner that does drone work, and they took photographs from a drone. And this is the photograph of a few of the pondlets. Then they were able to analyze those photos to see where water chestnut was. So it's a really cool tool. They're actually at UMass planning on incorporating drone work into their program and teaching the students how to use them wisely and all the laws that are involved with doing it safely. So that was a really useful tool. But this is the kind of work we do have to do in some of our ponds. That's all water chestnut, the brighter green and behind. You can see them pulling the plants in. We had one partner helping us that had, it's kind of hard to tell, but he's got a John boat here. And in the bright yellow shirt there, he came in and was really helpful. We would offload our bags of plants into his boat and he'd take them off to shore and we could just keep pulling and pulling and pulling. And that's the same, that really dense spot that I showed you here. This is it after we cleaned out all the water chestnuts. So anything that's still floating on there, some other species. So it is possible, but it does take a lot of work. We took out, I think it was 8 tons of plants from the Brickyards last summer. 9 tons. So as much as one small and one larger African elephant put together. That line of garbage bags full of plants there is just from 2 days worth of pulling. But it's really satisfying, I have to say. because the rosettes are connected together by a single stem, like maybe 4 or 5 of them, when they get big, you're kind of reeling them in and you can clear out a fairly big area really quickly. So it's actually a fun project. Even my husband's coming out now, and he's my right-hand person. But you can see these are some of the sites, a lot of the sites, and how they range in the watershed. That's Connecticut down below and Massachusetts up above. So So it really is, it's our summer project. There are all these other invasive species out there. This is one we decided that we want to tackle, but because we spend so much effort on this one, we don't get to a whole lot of others. But I will show you a couple that we do. You're wondering probably, is it worth doing this year after year after year? Well, this is one of the sites that's done by one of our partners at Massachusetts Audubon. This is actually right there in their sanctuary. You can see they started out with really a lot of plants, over a ton's worth of plants, almost a ton and a half in the first few years. And then they got it down really low. Then they had a spike. And after that, they decided to go out twice a year instead of just the once that they had been doing. And ever since then, they've really kept it low. So it's just a really fun paddle at that point. You know, you're just going and picking a few plants here and there. So they're down to like 30 or 40 pounds of plants in a season. So that's our hope, is that we can get all the sites down to that point and maybe find an adopter for each one so that our refuge can get off onto other things or just continue to work on the new ones as they come to our attention. This is just showing the beauty of early detection and rapid response. So that one blip, you know, we never seen any water chestnut in this pond until 2004 or 5, it looks like, from this angle. And we pulled it out and have never seen anything since. So it never had a chance to drop those seeds and create that large patch that it had the potential to. So this is just as a short list of the partners who've helped with the Water Chestnut Project. So people or different organizations may, you know, bring their canoe trailer. They may provide refreshments. They may help us get the permits. So they all have something to offer. Norcross Sanctuary, for instance, brings their summer crew out once or twice a summer. So by everybody working together, we're able to do this project. I mentioned that it doesn't leave much time for other species. Luckily, Japanese stilt grass is later in the season when water chestnut is winding down. So we are trying to teach people about Japanese stilt grass, how to identify it. And this particular infestation was found in Northfield, which is our northernmost population that we know of. This particular species is hard, though, because it's a grass, so it looks like so many other grasses. It's just, we fear that it's kind of running under the radar screen and that it's much more widespread now than we'd hoped it would be. And so we're really not quite sure whether we can rein this one in or not. The other species we're working on is Mila Minute Vine. Doesn't really grow that fast, but it does grow 6 inches a day, which is pretty impressive. And it is in our watershed, but there's just like maybe 5 sites, and it's easier to identify, relatively easy to pull out. It's an annual, so again, if you can pull that plant out, it's dead. It doesn't leave behind roots that are going to grow again. So we've been trying to figure out a strategy for this one. Last year we had our Youth Conservation Corps members come out and help at the sites where we knew it was. And because it was such a droughty summer, the Mila Minute Vine was pretty wimpy, so we were lucky. But that's how vigorous it can grow. And so at this time of year, this is when we're trying to plan out our strategy for this coming season. We do encourage people to report in invasives. We're really involved with the setting up of the Invasive Plant Atlas of New England, which was a citizen scientist program where people would get trained to identify a wide range of invasive species. And then they'd go out in the field. They would take photographs of it, and then either online report these species in or use a phone app is available called Outsmart Invasives where the record just goes right automatically into this national database. We have spent some effort at trying to formalize partnerships in different parts of the watershed where there might be a group of people who are interested in doing invasive species work. And this is based on cooperative weed management areas that have been really successful out west and have been kind of moving eastward. You can see that the whole state of New York is split up into these partnerships. And New York is the stellar role model. They really have taken invasive species seriously, and the state has put, are you from New York? They put a lot of effort toward it, and they're really leaps and bounds ahead of us in New England. But these are the areas where the stars are, where we did help with getting grant money for these partnerships. And again, these partnerships are bringing what they can to the table. It might be good grant writers. It might be a good group of volunteers that they have available that can help people who are just good at organizing. So it just varies from partnership to partnership. We had a grant, I think it was from 2010 and 11, or right around that time period, where we helped get some of these started, and some of them are still going. Some of them kind of, they still maintain some connections, but they're not as active. So the one that's in Westfield, Massachusetts, the Westfield Invasive Species Partnership, it's actually the Westfield River Watershed, they're going strong, and that one up in the upper watershed. And then a couple other ones are still going, but a couple have fizzled out as well. But they're, those that are still going are doing really good work. And by focusing just on the one place that they really care about, it just makes more sense rather than those of us who are trying to do things in the whole watershed. So when we had that grant, we did these train the trainer workshops. I showed you some photos on that, on learning the newer species that were entering the watershed. And then we did an analysis to see what were the most important areas to try to protect from invasives, those that were had the best biodiversity or most resilient to climate change. And then we spent a lot of time networking these cooperative invasive species management area members. So we still maintain some connections, and we'll probably have times when we have projects that we can get these people back together again. But this is our main force of people in the summertime, a daily for 5 weeks crew of youth. So they've been doing a lot of great work. This is down there. That's a bittersweet vine. That was their prize bittersweet that they'd gotten that particular day. That's in Springfield or Longmeadow, Massachusetts, but their crew is based out of Springfield. So it's a lot of urban youth, which is really cool because they're getting out into the woods. Some of them have never been in the woods before, and it's a great opportunity to start learning about nature and some of the skills that go along with building trails and planting and managing invasives. Planting natives, I mean. And that's what they're doing up there, is planting trees after the tornado went through Springfield. And they're instrumental to the Water Chestnut Project. So that's all I have for you tonight, but I'd like to entertain questions. Yes?
If I'm pulling up garlic mustard and it is just flowering but hasn't set seed yet, can I just leave it on the ground, or do I need to take it away?
It actually has, the question was, if you've got garlic mustard that's already flowering, does it have to be disposed of in a judicious manner? And the answer is yes, unfortunately. Once it's flowered, it has enough reserves in it to produce seeds. So yeah. But if you can catch it before it flowers, then you don't have to worry. And the only problem I see with that is you probably want to just lay it there on the ground where you picked it up from, because probably there's soil attached that has seeds in the soil. So those seeds might grow even, but at least they'll be where the plant came out of. So it's likely you'll be pulling in that same place for a while anyway because of the seed longevity. The other questions? Yes.
Go ahead. As far as you know, do you have any hardy kiwi in the Connecticut Riverbank?
There is intentional plantings of hardy kiwi in the Connecticut River watershed, and we have not found any that have been going awry like they have out here in the Berkshires. Are you familiar with the really nasty infestations?
Extremely.
Yeah, yeah. You might want to describe what it's like to these folks.
Well, some of your shots of bittersweet, I find bittersweet to be tame compared to kiwi. It just grows up mature, healthy trees and sends all of its heaviest stuff up to the top so that it's much more apt to pull the trees down. And then it grows up the next batch, so you form these huge amphitheaters of kiwi. And in the center, we've got patches that are 5 to 6 feet deep of just kiwi vine with nothing else growing in the middle at all. And I guess at Kennedy Park, it's now covering 85 acres as a monoculture, and then other areas that are equally big where it's coming along, but not a monoculture yet.
It's amazing. Yes. And that particular species is kind of interesting because Dan mentioned to you that I'm on the Massachusetts Invasive Plant Advisory Group, or MIPAG, and we've been trying to gather as much information on that particular species. This group is the group that evaluates species for invasiveness in Massachusetts. So it's our list that's the kind of the official list. And hardy kiwi came to our attention from Mass Audubon because it's on one of their properties. And it, we just didn't have enough data to list it up until this past year. And now that we know about those 85 acres, in fact, there's actually 15 more acres too. Somehow the number of 100 acres has come to our group. And they're not just in a single patch either. We can tell that they're being dispersed, and that's one of the criteria that an invasive plant has to meet, is that it doesn't just spread out from one place. It has to be able to jump spatial gaps. So there's these different patches of hardy kiwi. So we were finally able to feel like we had enough information that we could say, yes, we should list this as invasive. But unfortunately, not everybody's on the same page with that, because this is a species that, well, you know about the regular kiwi and how tasty it is. Well, hardy kiwi is really good. And it's not all fuzzy either. The fruits are small, but it's tasty. And so it's been promoted as this perennial food crop by permaculturalists. And so when it came time to have a hearing as to whether we could list this species or not, there was a big turnout from people who didn't want to lose that from their repertoire of plants they could grow. And then there's these other people who are trying to manage these terrible infestations. So I didn't get to hear that conversation, but I heard that there were adamant folks on both sides. Were you there by any chance?
Yes, I was.
You were.
I was testifying about how bad it is and jumping spatial gaps, and we're finding it more and more throughout the Berkshires, and hoping we've got some CLA students who are going to help us with mapping and looking for it in new places, because it's a nightmare from our perspective.
Yes. So does everyone know who this is? And do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Jane Wynn with Berkshire Environmental Action Team.
I thought that must be you, Jane.
We've emailed back.
Yes, we've never met in person. Yeah, so thank you for describing that. It's a pretty impressive plant. Yeah, if you go down to Kennedy Park, you'll be amazed because it's just the way she... It's almost like if you could consider a single species as a wonderful thing, it would be like a Shangri-La because it's growing up in all these rocky areas and you're walking underneath it and there's all these vines just hanging and it's kind of pretty if you don't know how scary it actually is. Yeah. Any other questions?
Yeah, I was wondering about when you purchase new properties, do you check them for invasive plants first? And is that a criteria for...
It's not. I kind of wish it was. Yeah, but no, it's more, it's potential. Usually we go after things that are wetlands or have endangered species on them, have the potential to be very biodiverse. So yeah, I never know what I'm going to be faced with. And it's not me that chooses the properties. So yeah, I don't know. We don't know. Mm-hmm. I wish. Yes?
Japanese knotwood?
Knotweed, yes.
Knotweed. Mm-hmm. Is that pretty invasive throughout the state, or?
Yes.
It reared its ugly head on our property right after Hurricane Irene. And it's been marching closer and closer to the house, and we realized it was inundating some of our fruit trees, our gardens. Like, you pull it out, and like five come back. It's pretty scary. So
it is. So the question is Japanese knotweed. It's very invasive. I live in the Deerfield River watershed, and it's the poster child of Japanese knotweed. It's just amazing, and because it usually grows in wetter areas like along shorelines, you have to be so careful about the use of herbicide. When you first had it there, it's too bad you didn't know, because when it first shows up after a storm like that, the folks up in Vermont were realizing when they're just really little and just fragments taking hold, you can pluck them out really easily. But once they start to send those roots down, it's much harder. And then, of course, they grow into massive roots. We had a workshop several years ago, and the speaker brought in a Japanese knotweed root. And it was... He brought a chunk that was this long. And in the center, it was this big around. And at each end, it was still this big around. So you can imagine how far out it must have gone. And so when it's like that underground and you don't see that, you think that, you know, you're pulling up plants, but it has so much reserves that it can just shoot all these up. You still might be young enough that you might be able to make some headway by trying to dig up roots, but that can create some problems.
We mapped out the property line and said, this is our wall where we're going to fight until, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so then we dug out all the dirt, trucked it off, brought in new dirt, rolled it down, then covered it with plastic, like thick tarp, covered that with dirt, and covered that with mulch. And then we built a stone wall all around it. And then there's pots and paving stones. I mean, it's a garden. It's a rock garden with the plants on top rather than in the dirt. And still that knotweed came underneath top. We're talking like from here to the screen, from where I am. And popped over here, and it's popping up in the grass.
Wow.
And making its way towards the house. And it's like I got the little Roundup and I'm squirting the
blue. Yeah, yeah.
But my God, it almost killed, we have a pear tree. And it was just surrounding it where it was taller than the little pear tree.
Yikes.
And that's when we decided, okay, it's it or us, and it's not going to be us. But yeah, so I was wondering if you had any words of wisdom. And I noticed we have those hanging things also on the trees by the water, so perhaps I should rip that out.
Find out what it is. Is it the orange berries?
I don't think there's any berries. It's just really thick vines, like the kind you make wreaths out of,
mm-hmm.
except it's wrapping itself around all the trees.
Yeah, yeah. Very well could be bittersweet. Could be grapevine, which is a native plant and good for wildlife, but you do have to be careful that it's
wrapped around
bringing
this
down
is
everything.
All since Hurricane Irene.
Wow.
Because we lost some trees
yeah.
that we saw floating down the river.
Yeah. One thing about knotweed is that the roots, they've been trying this out, and I haven't heard the results yet, but there is some sort of a root barrier you can it's a real thick sheet of some sort of heavy plastic, I think. So you can dig and put that down as a barrier, and the roots aren't supposed to be able to go through it. So, you know, when you're trying to...
Where the seams are, it actually sneaks itself.
Oh, so you've tried this?
And then it's become quite a joke, like in the neighborhood, because I'm going to give up on this.
Yeah, yeah. In Britain, they have knotweed, and I think there's something that has to do with if you purchase a house. If you're selling a house, you have to get rid of all the knotweed first because, yeah, and they're actually getting through the foundations of the houses and growing up into the house. It's just, it must be an even more, well, I think it's an even more vigorous subspecies or variety or something there, but yeah, hopefully you won't be doing that.
And I did notice that it only popped up in the areas where we lost the trees. So where it's still heavily wooded, there's no knotweed.
Yeah.
But it's in where we lost the trees. And it's just popping up, and then it started going up that path.
It is a sun lover. It is, yeah. And dappled shade. It's in the ravine on my neighbor's property behind me, and it's relatively shady back there, so you can see, you know, where it's in the sun, it's doing really good, and in the shade, it peters out, but it still can grow a little bit there.
Further and further, closer to and just put plastic and just...
Yeah, but you are using some Roundup, it sounds like.
Well, then I read, there was an article in some thing that was speaking to how it's very cancer. Mm-hmm. It increases your risk of cancer.
Mm.
So perhaps I thought maybe I shouldn't be out there every day.
Yeah.
So I'm digging it up, covering it with plastic, putting rocks on top of that, and just working my way.
Right.
But
well, good luck
amazing.
With that.
It's amazing.
It is, yeah. And so many of these are like that. They just have a really nasty, they're just survivors. They've got these incredible adaptations for survival.
You showed somebody injecting the stems of knotweed. Is that something that homeowners can do?
Well,
yeah, on your own property, you can. Yep, yeah. So that you wouldn't be handling it, you know, as... maybe as much, injecting into the stem, the plant is still photosynthesizing, so it's actually carrying the herbicide down in, as opposed to if you cut it off and just drip herbicide into it. So if you haven't given up on the idea of using herbicide,
I was wondering
that is
like
technique.
Salt or something natural, no.
Not on knotweed. No, it's barely the kind of the organic remedies of invasive plants aren't really that useful even on wimpy ones, let alone Japanese knotweed. Sorry.
All right, we've come to the end of our time tonight.